morning.
Good morning.
So, as you know, I've been talking about Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way, Chapter 6 on Patience, but I thought today that I would back up and talk about Chapter 1 of this text. So, you know, for those of you who may not know this story, Shanti Deva was an 8th century Indian monk who was attending Nalanda University. Nalanda University is a real place in India, and there are still ruins of the university. So it was considered a major center of learning in India at that time. And Shanti Deva was a student there. I originally heard this story from tapes of a series of lectures that Robert Thurman gave at San Francisco Zen Center, maybe in the 80s, early 90s. So here's the story that he told about Shanti Deva. So Shanti Deva was a young man, and he wasn't very much revered by his fellow students because he didn't attend class, and he slept through most of the day. And his nickname was Eat, Shit, Sleep. Of course, that would have been in Sanskrit. I don't know what that is in Sanskrit. So he wasn't well regarded by his fellow students. And it was customary at the end of the time that you were there that you would have a public examination. And everybody would come, including the king. And I mean, it was a huge event. So because they were so disrespectful of him, they built a really high dais that he would have to kind of crawl up to get onto his seat. So he sort of have to embarrass himself just to get up and get up there. So he did. Now, let me back up a little bit. The reason why he wasn't going to class was because at night, all night long, he was receiving direct transmission of the teachings from Manjushri. Okay? So that's why he wasn't going to class, because he was kind of tired during the day. Manjushri is the bodhisattva of wisdom. So, you know, he was being visited by this high-level bodhisattva every night and being kept up by that person. So, anyway, comes time for the examination. And he's up there on his high dais, and he's talking. And everybody's kind of like, ha, 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 you know, like, let's see you kind of strut your stuff, thinking that he was going to fall flat on his face. But instead, he launched into what is now the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way. And when he got to about, you know, I don't know, chapter 7 or something, he lifted up off of his seat and started to levitate and move over the top of the crowd. And by now, everybody was so gobsmacked by the amazing dharma that he was presenting that they were running after him, writing it down, you know, because he was like floating off into the next county or whatever. So that's the story of how this text came about. So Shanti Deva was a real guy. Now, whether or not he actually levitated and was communing with Manjushri at night, I don't know. But the fact of his existence was a real thing. So I thought what I would do today is I would read chapter 1, which is short, to you, and say something about the verses. So this is a text that's written in verse. The text is it comes in two versions. One is Sanskrit, a translation from Sanskrit, and then there's a translation from Tibetan. The Tibetans use this as a formative text. It's a really important text in Tibetan Buddhism. And so this translation, which was done by Stephen Batchelor back, I don't know, in the 70s or 80s, and is not in print anymore, but this is from the Tibetan. So this is what Shanti Deva said. He said, respectfully, I prostrate myself to the Buddhas. And if you get the weekly quote, which isn't weekly, I did one recently and it was on this first verse. Respectfully, I prostrate myself to the Buddhas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya. So the Dharmakaya is one of the three bodies of the Buddha. But I will say to you, from a Zen point of view, I would say that you can understand Dharmakaya as things just as they are. Reality just as it is. So this is this essential nature. So these Buddhas are endowed with the Dharmakaya as well as their noble sons or their noble elders, and to all who are worthy of veneration. So that's the first verse where Shantideva says, he just starts out and he says, you know, the first thing I have to say is that I have to bow down to all of those who come before me. I have to acknowledge that there is this lineage of practitioners and of Buddhas who are standing with me, who are standing next to me, who are all of reality itself, supporting me in my efforts. And then he says, here I shall explain, here being the text, here I shall explain how to engage in the vows of the Buddha elders, the meaning of which I have condensed in accordance with the scriptures. So he's saying, I'm going to talk about these teachings, and they're based on the scriptures. So they're not something that I just completely made up on my own. So this is really important, you know, in Buddhism, is we're not making things up. We're doing these practices that have been done for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So we're engaged in this activity in which we are standing on the shoulders of the people who have come before us. There is nothing here that has not been explained before, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. So he's being humble, right? Being humble is good. It's always good. Keeps you out of trouble. Therefore, lacking any intention to benefit others, I write this in order to acquaint it to my mind. So, therefore, lacking any intention to benefit others, I write this in order to acquaint it to my mind. And then he goes on to say, for due to acquaintance with what is wholesome, the force of my faith may for a short while increase because of these words. If, however, these words are seen by others, equal in fortune to myself, it may be meaningful for them. So he's saying, you know, he says, I'm not writing this with some notion that I'm bringing the teachings to other people. So this is a kind of humble way of saying, you know, he doesn't have some notion of himself that he's such a hotshot, you know, that he's going to like kind of bring the tablets down from the mountains. He's saying, you know, actually, I'm writing this because I need this. I need these teachings. So I'm writing these teachings down for myself so that I can remind myself to practice. So he says, for due to acquaintance with what is wholesome, the force of my faith may for a short while increase because of these words. So we say, I'm going back, I'm looking at the scriptures, I'm standing on the shoulders of those who've come before me, I'm looking at what they've written down, I'm looking at the teachings that they've offered, and I'm using this, I'm kind of rewriting it my own way. And don't we have to do that? You know, it's like we go to the scriptures, we go to the teachings, and we absorb them. You know, as Dogen says in Zui Monkey, it's like you're walking across a field that's with a lot of dew on the grass, and you get across the field and you go, wow, my pants are really wet. Or in his case, he said, my robes are really wet. This way that we have to completely absorb and immerse ourselves in the teachings that come before, in the peoples who understood before, and yet simultaneously we have to understand these teachings in a way that's contemporary, right? And that we have faith that these teachings, no matter how ancient they are about human beings. So in that way, they're about us. In that way, they are about our contemporary understanding of the nature of our experience. So first we have to completely absorb the teachings so that we actually understand what they are, and then we have to take those teachings and apply them to our own life. So he says, and if these words are seen by others equal in fortune to myself, it may be meaningful for them. So he says, you know, I hope that this is helpful to other people as well. And then what does he mean by saying this part here about equal in fortune to myself? So he goes on to kind of explain that. He says, leisure and endowment are very hard to find. So what he's saying here is the time to study the Dharma is really hard to find, and the capacity to study the Dharma is hard to find. So when he says endowment, what he's talking about is we are born in a time and a place where we probably have enough food, we have a roof over our heads, people are not dropping bombs on us, you know, we have the mental capacity to study the teachings. All of these causes and conditions come together where we are able to connect with the Dharma. So we don't, he's saying, don't take that for granted. Don't take your life for granted. You know, that you have, as Dogen says, the pivotal opportunity to study the Dharma here. So he says, leisure and endowment are very hard to find. And since they accomplish what is meaningful for man, men or women, obviously, this was not written before women stood up and said, me too, you know. So he says, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for man, if I do not take advantage of them now, how will such a perfect opportunity come about again? So here we are, you know, we are like in this wonderful place and time, even though it may not feel that way. We are in this wonderful place and time as individuals. Here we are able to absorb the Dharma. We have reached that place. We have had a rebirth. We are in a situation, particularly just as human beings from a Buddhist point of view. You know, we're not born as animals. We're not born as asuras who are fighting all the time, titans who are fighting all the time. We're not born as gods who are having such a grand time, right, because of their karma, that they don't even think about the Dharma. They're just kind of, I don't know if they're hedonistic or not, but they're certainly not studying the Dharma in this way. There's this notion that in Buddhism that it takes a particular constellation of conditions for us to want to study the Dharma. And part of that constellation of conditions is some suffering. Because if we're not suffering, we probably are not so interested in this practice, because actually practice requires of us that we do some things that might be make us uncomfortable. You know, dropping the self is not an easy practice. This way in which we're asked to acknowledge, drop our own agenda, and do what's the best thing for the wider group. And Genja Koan Goan says, as you know, to carry the self forward, to carry the selfish self forward is delusion. To allow myriad things to come forward and meet you is realization. So that's his definition of what it is to be enlightened. That we take into account and we engage with the myriad things that are happening in this moment, that whatever moment we're in, and we weigh that and we respond. That's the Bodhisattva practice. That's the Buddha practice. And so Shantideva is saying, you know, we should take advantage of this now. We should take advantage of this and not waste this. This is an opportunity to practice. And every moment that we have that advantage, you don't know, you could be run over by a car tomorrow. You could lose your mind tomorrow. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We have this notion that probably things will kind of keep going on the way they're going on now. But that's not necessarily true. So practice like your hair is on fire. That's a nice Zen saying, you know. When I first started practicing, that image to me was kind of like, it would be like I'd run around going, but like this, right? Like that was practice. And I realized, you know, no, that's not what that means. It means don't be, it doesn't mean like be a crazy person running around, you know, with your hair on fire. It means the sense of immediacy. When our hair is on fire, it's got our attention. So this way that we immediately feel the Dharma in this moment. Then Shantideva says, just as a flash of lightning on a dark, cloudy night for an instant brightly illuminates all, likewise in this world, through the might of Buddha, a wholesome thought rarely and briefly appears. This idea, you know, that this... as Dogen also, spark from Flintstone. You know, this idea that like a flash of lightning, all of a sudden everything is illuminated and then bang, it's gone. And there we are in darkness again. So this way that when we have that opportunity to be illuminated, that we respond. that we step into that light, that we remember that and respond to that. Hence, virtue is perpetually feeble. It's like, hence, virtue is perpetually feeble, the great strength of evil being extremely intense. And except for a fully awakening mind, by what other virtue will it be overcome? So here he's positing this notion that there is good and evil, and that we need to have an awakened mind in order to respond. We live in times as human beings, and I suspect that this is always true. As human beings, I think we're always struggling between this desire to fulfill the needs of the self and this altruistic notion to want to respond to the whole. And so we're all on a continuum of that. Some people are awake to that, some people are not. So from a Buddhist point of view, we're trying to awaken this mind of responding to the whole, to responding to the greater good. So we're on this continuum, right? I would say evil is over here, and this is this mind in which you don't even have some notion of responding to a larger whole. It's more about me, 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 right? And then we go along, and we're over here, most altruistic mind. We are sometimes, we're not either here or here. We're like here, 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 depending on the causes and conditions of the situation. So sometimes we're like, I don't want to practice, you know, I don't want to do that. And sometimes we're just like, I don't even have any notion of that. I don't even get it. And sometimes we're like, oh yeah, I totally understand this. I'm going to put my effort into this. I'm going to respond. And sometimes we just respond. Don't even think about it. We just do the right thing. So we need to acknowledge the fact that we're also kind of all over the map. So this virtue, this struggle, if you will, with the self about trying to engage with the world in a way that is helpful to each other, to the world, to our peers, to our enemies, to everyone, right? Including the self, right? So you can't leave the self out here. He says, by what other virtue will it be overcome? What other virtue, you know? So we live in, right now, in times that it seems like things are extremely polarized. And we all have pretty strong opinions about what we think about things. Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh, I don't know if you watch the hearings, you know, and I'm sure if you're like I am, your relationship to the various testimony that you heard had in some ways to do with your preconceived ideas about what it is that you were hearing and who it was that you were hearing it from. I think that's very common for us as human beings to engage in that activity. How do we take those strong feelings and interact with each other that is virtuous? How do we take those strong feelings and interact with each other with an open mind, with an awakened mind? And where does that happen? It only happens when we're interacting with each other one-on-one. You know? Shanti Davis saying, this practice is happening right here, right now, with particular people in a particular situation, in a particular way, and we need to step up to the plate and respond. Because that's how we engage virtuously with each other. That's how we overcome, if you will, these aspects of ourselves and others that he's characterizing as evil, but I think that that's kind of a loaded word, particularly because it has Christian connotations. But this way in which we engage with that less enlightened self of ourselves and others. All the Buddhas have contemplated for many eons, have seen it to be beneficial, for by it the limitless masses of beings will quickly attain the supreme state of bliss. So this awakened mind, this practice, this engaging, this altruism, this way of taking up this vow, taking up the bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Like, that's like a total koan, right? How in the world do you do that? Well, of course, the way you do it is that you have to do it in this moment, and 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 this moment. Dharma gates are boundless. I don't want to go in that gate. Okay, I'll step in there a little bit and see how the water is. You know, that we engage ourselves in that. That we engage in that process. Those who wish to destroy the many sorrows of their conditioned existence. Those who wish all beings to experience a multitude of joys. And those who wish to experience much happiness should never forsake the awakened mind. So he's saying here, if you want to help others to alleviate their suffering, if you want to yourself experience joy, and if you want to experience happiness, you should never let go of the teachings. You should always follow these teachings. Follow this aspiration for the awakened mind. These are actually the three pure precepts. You know, avoid all evil, do all good, and benefit all beings. So these precepts of, you know, I want to avoid doing things that are unskillful. I want to avoid doing things that create suffering. I want to do things that benefit or do good for myself and others. And I, in general, have this notion, this aspiration to benefit all beings. And then Shantideva says, the moment an awakened mind arises in those fettered and weak, the moment an awakened mind arises in those fettered and weak, in the jail of cyclic existence, they will be named followers of the Buddha and will be revered by both people and gods of the world. So he's saying, maybe this is a little bit of appeal to our small self, which is, you know, we will be looked upon favorably by all beings if we make this effort. But I would say that, in general, don't we look favorably upon the people that we know are having a difficult time, and yet they continue to try to do what is most beneficial? You know, aren't we much more likely to be forgiving of someone that we perceive who is actually making this effort to figure it out, even though they're doing a really maybe not so good job of it? This way in which when we encounter people who are belligerent, angry, aggressive, maybe even victim-y, those kinds of things that are difficult, those emotions that are difficult for us, our tendency is not to be so open to them. Now, from a Buddhist bodhisattva point of view, we should always do that. We must always go beyond those first impressions and actually do our best to respond to everyone, no matter how much aversion we might feel, to respond to everyone with this mind of bodhicitta, this mind, awakened mind, an altruistic mind. The moment an awakening mind arises, so the moment that this mind of wanting to engage in this bodhisattva practice, the moment that this mind arises in those fettered and weak in the jail of cyclic existence. That's us, guys. Fettered and weak, you know, in the jail of cyclic existence. I mean, that's a great phrase, right? It's a great phrase. Here we are, like we're bound up and we're feeling overwhelmed and don't have much energy for all of this. And here we are in the midst of cyclic existence, which is this, you know, life of the Saha world, you know, the Buddha field of the Saha world, Shakyamuni Buddha's field of the Saha world, the world of suffering. So this way in which we, you know, it's like, it's, there's, as Roseanne Madan said, there's always something. You know, remember those early Saturday Night Live, Roseanne Madan, there's always something. So that in this Saha world, there is always something. There's always something to do in this Bodhisattva practice. It is like the supreme gold-making elixir, for it transforms the unclean body we have taken into the priceless jewel of a Buddha form, therefore firmly sees this awakened mind. So I don't know if that might be a little hard to understand just listening to it. So he says, this practice, this awakened mind, is like the supreme gold-making elixir. So this, how do you make, you know, gold out of lead? How do you make gold out of something that is impure? Because gold is associated with being pure. How do we purify? How do we do this? So that is this practice. This practice is what makes gold. For it transforms the unclean body we have taken into the priceless jewel of the Buddha form. Therefore, firmly sees this awakened mind. Now, some of this language I think is a little difficult for us as modern folks. And also, it's Shantideva was not a Zen Buddhist, right? I don't know what school of Buddhism he ascribed to, but he was not a Zen Buddhist. So, you know, what we're saying here is in Zen, we say we are already that priceless jewel. We are already Buddha nature. All being, all things, the whole universe, everything is Buddha nature. As Dogen famously said, we do not have Buddha nature, we are Buddha nature. So this practice is gold-making. It's a gold-making elixir. So what it does is it brings forward this Buddha nature, which is already there. So we don't have to live lifetime after lifetime. It's like a turn, you know, a turn towards what is already fully presencing. So Dogen says in Busho, he says there is Buddha nature and there is Buddhahood, right? So Buddhahood is this way in which we actually enact and bring forward this practice. So we have Buddha nature, which is our inherent existence. It is what we are, what all being is. Everything is Buddha nature. And yet simultaneously, as Suzuki Roshi supposedly said, there is work to be done, right? So this work we're doing is turning this gold, is turning this practice into this golden elixir. It transforms, I won't say unclean body, I won't say our delusion. It transforms our delusion into this priceless jewel of the awakened mind. Therefore, firmly seize this practice. Firmly, you know, take on this practice. Since the limitless mind of the sole guide of the world, that would be Shakyamuni, since the limitless mind of the sole guide of the world has, upon thorough investigation, seen its preciousness, seen the preciousness of this awakened mind, all beings wishing to be free from worldly abodes should firmly take hold of this precious awakened mind. So firmly take hold. Firmly engage, firmly immerse yourself in this practice. All other virtues are like the plantain tree. So the plantain tree is like in the banana tree family. And I believe what he's referring to is this tree is made up of layers and layers and layers and layers and layers that can all be kind of stripped away. So you can pull apart the trunk of this tree. He says, all other virtues are like the plantain tree, for after bearing fruit, they simply perish. But the perennial tree of the awakened mind unceasingly bears fruit and thereby flourishes without end. So he's saying all these other virtues are perhaps ephemeral, that they might not be lasting, but that if we engage in this totality of this altruism, of this practice of the awakened mind, that we can regenerate and keep bearing fruit time after time after time after time. Like entrusting myself to a brave man when greatly afraid, by entrusting myself to this awakened mind, I shall be swiftly liberated, even if I have committed extremely unbearable evils. Why then do the conscious, why then do the conscientious not devote themselves to this? So he's saying, if you go to this practice and have faith in this practice, it's like entrusting yourself to this brave man when we're really afraid. Isn't that true? You know, when we have faith in the practice itself, it's like when we are most at sea and we feel like we can't find our bearings, we go back to the practice. So I think, you know, in Zen, in some ways, we don't think of Zen in a way as a devotional practice, but actually it's very much a devotional practice. When we come to service and we chant the sutras, when we bow, when we engage in this mandala of the totality of our experience together, this is a devotional practice. This is a practice that we have deep faith in, but we can't intellectually explain it. So I could, you know, tell you, we can go through the sutras that we chant during service and say, oh, this means this, this means this, this means this. But essentially what we're doing when we're chanting them together is we're engaging in a faith practice. So this practice of when I feel most at sea and I don't know and I can't remember what the practice is, for whatever reason, we sit down and we do zazen, or we sit down in front of our altar with a picture of a bodhisattva, or the picture of the Dalai Lama, or a picture of somebody who inspires us, and we offer incense, and we say, yes, you went there before me, you were there before me, and I have faith in you, I have faith in this practice, that if I stick with this, it will make sense to me. If I go to my teacher and say, I totally cannot figure this out, I am so depressed, I can't find a place to enter in. And our teacher says, actually, have you thought about this? Have you done this? And then we wholeheartedly say, yes, I'll try that. I'll do that. So this faith we have in the practice itself is very, very, very important. And he says, no matter what you've done, if you have this mind, this conscientious mind, why don't you devote yourself to doing this practice? Why don't you throw yourself wholeheartedly into this practice? In brief, he says, the awakened mind should be understood to be of two types. The mind that aspires to awaken and the mind that ventures to do so. So this is interesting because there's that aspiration to awaken and then there's doing the practice. Right? So we come to lecture and we hear these lectures and we go away and we say, yeah, I'm going to practice. Boy, I was inspired by that. I want to go out and practice. And then the first thing that happens to you, like on your way out here, you know, it's like somebody's coming down the road. Oh, I bet I can get out there in front of them. You know, I bet I can get there faster than they can. You know, it's like, or, boy, I'm pissed at that person. I'm going to shoot them the finger or think bad thoughts about them or whatever I'm going to do on my way out. You know, it's like practice, smack this, you know. So these are the two kinds. You know, the second kind here is that, so there's the aspire to awaken, and the aspiring to awaken is very important. Don't let me put this down. But there is where the rubber meets the road, and you actually have to do the practice. So that's the second part, and that you venture to do so, that you actually do the practice. That's the hard stuff. You know, that's the stuff where you're like going, I don't want to do this. I am so mad at this person. It's like, I do not want to ever talk to them again. You know? Oh, yeah, well, I might have done something that might have contributed to the problem. But, you know, it's like, it's their fault. So I don't really have to apologize to them or ever speak to them again because it's really their fault. I mean, I had something to do with it, but really, you know. So it's theirs. It's not mine. So this way in which we have to go, yep, it's mine. Yeah, that was mine. I did something that wasn't very skillful. Or maybe the fact that they're suffering and they're doing things that are unskillful. And maybe it's time for me to practice and step up to the plate, you know, even though I don't want to. This way that's the hard part, right? That's the hard part about doing practice is that we're being actually, you know, to do it. We say, you know, the rubber meets the road. So we're like the tire. Sometimes we feel like we're like, there's the road and the tire and we're like, you know, we're like getting run over. So, you know, our practice, our faith in the practice pumps us back up again. Okay, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to stand up off the road and actually engage. So this distinction is very important. Although great fruits occur in cyclic existence from the mind that aspires to awaken, an uninterrupted flow of merit does not ensue if one does not engage in the practice. And for him or who has perfectly seized him or her, who has perfectly seized this mind with the thought never to turn away from totally liberating the infinite forms of life, from that time hence, even while asleep or unconcerned, a force of merit equal to the sky will perpetually ensue. This is interesting. He's saying, you know, you can actually benefit from the practice in your sleep. You remember you'd like, a language program? You know, if I listen to it at night while I'm asleep, this language program, I'll wake up, I can speak Japanese now, you know. So he's saying, even in your sleep, something's happening. Even in your sleep, in this practice that you're engaged in, that it's actually efficacious, that something's happening. Even when you're not aware of it, something's happening. Dogen says, in Uji, he says, these devas on your right and left are always practicing. They're always helping you to practice. So this way in which the whole world is engaged in the activity of helping you to practice. The whole world is feeding you. The whole world is helping you. Everything in this world wants you to practice. So even when we're asleep, and sleep can be a metaphor, even in delusion, this whole world wants us to practice. I'm going to skip to the end here. So, for those who are deprived of happiness and burdened with many sorrows, it satisfies them. The practice, this bodhicitta mind, this mind, awakened mind, satisfies them with all joys and dispels all suffering. So even when we're caught and deprived and we're sad and feeling badly about things, we're burdened by many sorrows, this practice can bring us joy. This faith in this practice can help us kind of get out of that hole. I would say that that's our faith. That's our faith. Our faith in this practice. It also clears, he says, it clears away confusion. If whoever repays a kind deed is worthy of some praise, then what need to mention the bodhisattva who does good without being asked of him or her? So that's what the practice is. That's our practice that we're striving for, is to do good, to respond in a wholesome way, to do what is most helpful in that situation, to engage in this bodhisattva mind without being asked to do it. The world honors as virtuous a woman or man who sometimes gives a little plain food disrespectfully to a few beings, and that satisfies them for only half a day. So what he's saying here is that sometimes people engage in altruistic activities, like they go and they give food to the poor or something like that, but that actually that's not who they are in the rest of their life. So he's saying that the merit of doing some action like that in lieu of doing the practice doesn't count for much. So we can't deceive ourselves by saying, oh yeah, I took my stuff to the Goodwill and now I can be an asshole at the supermarket. It's not like that. So he's saying you have to keep doing this practice, daily, moment by moment. What need to be said then of one who eternally bestows the peerless bliss of the Buddhas upon limitless numbers of beings, thereby fulfilling all their hopes? I bow down to the bodhisattvas in whom the sacred, precious mind is born. I bow down to the bodhisattvas in whom the sacred, precious mind is born. I seek refuge in that source of joy who brings happiness even to those who harm him. That's the last verse of this opening section. So in this opening chapter of this text. He's laying out his argument, if you will, about why we engage this mind, why we practice, what this practice is, the faith of this practice, those who go before us in this practice, the veneration of this practice, and that we are going to do the tough work of this practice. And then he says, I bow down. I humble myself before. I have great faith in. I'm kind of in awe of those bodhisattvas and buddhas who went before me, in whom this sacred, precious mind is born. And it is a sacred, precious mind. And of course, it's not just about Buddhism, right? This Buddhists don't have a corner on this market. This sacred, precious mind of the desire to be helpful in this world as opposed to not being helpful. He says, I seek refuge in that. To seek refuge in that. I think that's very powerful. Who brings to happiness even those who harm him. And that's the tough part, right? Bringing happiness to those who harm us. I rest his case.